Good evening, I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz joins the Democratic ticket as Kamala Harris's vice presidential pick. How he could bolster support in the Midwest.
Tropical storm Debbie stalls over the southeast, dumping torrential rains on Georgia and the Carolinas.
And 140 stars over 50 years, the wall that memorializes CIA members who are rarely recognized publicly.
The wall is not an abstraction. You know, each of those stars has a profound human story behind them.
Welcome to the NewsHour. The contenders for this November's presidential race are officially set.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is joining Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris as her running mate this November, and he's joining her on stage tonight at a rally in Philadelphia.
Walz is a familiar face in Minnesota and the halls of power in Washington, D.C., but a relative newcomer to the national stage. Along a white picket fence in St. Paul, Minnesota today, a crowd gathers to send off Governor Tim Walz. After getting the call from presidential nominee Kamala Harris to join the Democratic ticket.
Listen, I want you to do this with me.
I would be honored, Madam Vice President.
The duo is up against the Republican ticket of former President Donald Trump and Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, who went after his newly named counterpart at a Philadelphia rally today.
Tim Walz's record is a joke. He's been one of the most far-left radicals in the entire United States government at any level. The reason I didn't say a whole lot about Tim Walz is because the Democrats have showed a willingness to pull a little switcheroo on us. So I don't even know if we're actually going to get Tim Walz out of this campaign.
Walz, a 60-year-old father of two, is currently in his second term as Minnesota governor, with a 54% state approval rating in a July morning consult survey and a reputation for a relatable, some say folksy, approach.
I think we're going to go do the slingshot.
Which I don't know what it is, and they're keeping it from me.
And though he's racked up a substantial political record over nearly two decades in public office, Walz hasn't been very well known outside his home state.
Good job, Dad.
Oh, thanks, Hope.
In 2020, that began to change.
Generations of pain is manifesting itself in front of the world, and the world is watching.
After a police officer murdered George Floyd in Minneapolis, Walz condemned the killing, and days later, after some protests turned violent, called in the National Guard to respond to rioters.
Everything that we believe in, these people are trying to destroy. So if you are on the streets tonight, it is very clear you are not with us. You do not share our values, and we will use the full strength of goodness and righteousness to make sure that this ends.
The right criticized his response as slow, and Walz himself later acknowledged the, quote, abject failure of that response. In 2023, after his party won control of the Minnesota House and Senate, Walz signed into law a laundry list of Democratic priorities, providing free meals to K-12 students, the largest child tax credit in the country, enshrining abortion rights into state law, increasing LGBTQ protections, legalizing marijuana, and granting voting rights to ex-offenders. His selection by Harris is seen by some as a nod to the party's progressive wing.
Do you think your record is an asset to the ticket, or would it risk fueling Trump's attacks as you being a big government liberal?
What a monster. Kids are eating and having full bellies so they can go learn, and women are making their own health care decisions, and we're a top five business state, and we also rank in the top three of happiness.
But earlier in his career on Capitol Hill, he was known as a moderate.
I intend to come here to Washington to provide authentic leadership.
In 2006, he flipped his Minnesota U.S. House seat from red to blue, becoming the highest-ranking enlisted veteran ever in Congress. Over six terms and a dozen years, he ranked among the most bipartisan lawmakers, supported ongoing operations in Iraq while opposing more boots on the ground, pushed for a minimum wage hike and prescription drug cost negotiations, voted against President Obama's 2009 Wall Street bailout plan, but backed the Affordable Care Act. Before entering politics, Walz served 24 years with the Army National Guard, enlisting at the age of 17. alongside his day job teaching high school social studies and coaching football. In recent weeks leading up to his selection, Walz made a name for himself as a willing warrior for Harris.
Are you what this ticket needs to be able to beat the Trump-Vance ticket?
Well, I don't know about that, Amna, but what I can tell you is that we will beat that ticket. This chaos that Donald Trump brings, this dystopian view of America, Kamala Harris's joy, you can feel it.
Going viral by branding the opposing ticket in this way.
Well, it's true. These guys are just weird.
The Harris-Walz campaign will spend the next week touring swing states with stops in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, North Carolina, Arizona, and Nevada, as it introduces the country to a new national political player and potential future vice president.
One of the biggest challenges for the Harris-Walz campaign will be introducing Governor Walz to the American people. Our new PBS NPR Maris poll out today shows that 71% of Americans don't know who he is. For more on the Minnesota governor, I'm joined now by Twin Cities PBS reporter Mary LaHammer. She's been following Walz's career for some 20 years. Mary, good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So you were outside his home earlier today as the news broke. Tell me a little bit about what you heard from people out there.
Yeah, it was an interesting environment. An organic crowd developed. There were folks walking their dogs out on a morning run, a walk, and decided to stay, and they actually got to see him depart in the motorcade and just started cheering for him out of the blue and then talking to them afterwards. They're excited. Minnesotans like to play an outsized role in national politics. They're kind of proud of it. I think people are learning the statistic that if Walz wins, 3 out of the last 6 Democratic vice presidents will be from Minnesota. But as your poll shows, he's got to introduce himself to the nation.
He does have an uphill battle there. The vast majority of Americans don't know who he is or don't know what to think of him. So the campaign, as we know, is already working to set that narrative with videos like this they released today.
I coached football and taught social studies for 20 years. And I tried to teach my students what small town Nebraska taught me: respect, compromise, service to country. And so when I went into government, that's what I carried with me.
So Mayor, you have covered him for some 20 years. What's the headline here for what people need to know about who is Tim Walz?
Yeah, I'll go back to his very first run for office. And I remember some trusted sources saying, you got to get down to this rural Republican district where this football coach is actually making a race of it and, you know, eventually flip the seat. I went back and studied that debate and tried to kind of ascertain how much he has changed. And it was interesting to me to see that he is still kind of was the fearless, self-effacing, but aggressive, quick on his feet. So he's been able to debate and really pivot for a long time, but introducing himself to a national audience will be new. He's used to the Minnesota press corps. He's done a lot of national news and was even surprised in our recent interview. We discussed how that Republicans are weird phrase, how we kind of coined that phrase. And he was almost embarrassed saying, oh gosh, shucks, I wasn't trying to be mean about it. So we'll see how those Midwestern tendencies go on the national stage.
So, Mary, some folks are hailing his selection here as a nod to progressives of the Democratic Party, but I had Demsoris tell me earlier today that he's actually much more moderate than many in the media make him out to be. What do you make of that?
It depends which office you're talking about. When he was a member of Congress from a rural, previously Republican district, he was much more of a moderate. Then when he became governor for the state, and his lieutenant governor, Peggy Flanagan, definitely took him in more of a progressive stance. And then he got an all-Democratic legislature, so ended up passing just a very large list of highly progressive items. So some folks say, was it a bait and switch? He originally ran on this concept of one Minnesota. We are still probably rather divided here.
Well, he is relatively popular at the state level, right? He has a 54% approval rating in Minnesota. What do his critics there say about him? And could any of those become vulnerabilities on the national stage?
Yeah, a good portion of his time in office as governor has been in front of a divided legislature. He recently had the all-Democratic trifecta. But before that, he had a lot of critics, and he had a hard road in divided government. Minnesota's a state, you know, 4 Democrats, 4 Republicans in Congress. We're slightly purple. And folks here are very critical of his time during the pandemic in particular. We had a lot of lockdowns. Of course, we had the riots following George Floyd's murder, and we're very critical of him being slow to send the National Guard out. Also during the pandemic, we had the largest fraud in the Feeding Our Future fraud case. I think the governor will probably be talking about the fact that those cases have been brought to justice and there have been convictions in both of those instances.
Big week from Minnesota. We know you'll be covering his career moving forward as well. That is Mary LaHammer of Twin Cities PBS joining us tonight. Mary, thank you. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar has known Governor Walz and worked with him for years, and she joins us now. Welcome back to the NewsHour.
Well, thanks, Jeff. It's wonderful to be back on.
Most voters are only now getting to know about Governor Walz and his background. You know him well. You were with him last night, in fact, at a private fundraiser for the Harris campaign. In your view, what are his strengths? How does he boost the ticket?
He's someone that is heartland all the way. He grew up in Nebraska in a farm, came out to Minnesota, signed up for the National Guard at age 17. And then he became a teacher, taught geography, always good to know in Washington, and then a high school football coach, and then went on to serve in the Guard, and in 2006 ran for Congress. And I think some of this gets lost in all the stories, but he was actually in one Congress in the top 10 of bipartisan members of Congress, served on the Vets Committee, the Ag Committee, did a lot on veteran suicides, and a lot on veterans issues in general, and was very well liked in Congress, and from there ran for governor. So I think it's really important people see this as someone who comes from humble roots, is someone who loves his country and has led students, has led soldiers, and of course has led our state in a very good way as governor, and always a unifying, optimistic force. And I think that you see that joy in how he campaigns and what he will bring to the ticket.
The Trump campaign is already pouncing, calling him dangerously liberal and saying that the Harris-Walz ticket is the most left-wing ticket in American history. He has championed progressive causes. How do you expect that he will defend his record?
Well, I went through how bipartisan he was and what he's done and how he won in a district, a rural district, one of only two Democrats in 100 years that ran and won in that district and did it over and over and over again. And then the other thing I would say is I think he's probably the first vice president that has stood in a deer stand in 10-degree Minnesota weather for hours and hours at a time. So I'm actually looking forward to that debate with J.D. Vance because Tim Walz is himself, he's loved, and he's blunt. Last night, there we are before he's going to be picked as vice president. He's walking around, no notes, giving a speech, always happy. And I just think that kind of joy has been missing in our politics. And he's able to respond to attacks, whether they're about he's too progressive or he's too this or he's too conservative, whatever it is. He does it with humor and facts. And that's a pretty good combination in politics today.
I'm told by sources familiar that what solidified VP Harris's pick of Walz was their chemistry, that when they met Sunday at her residence, that she viewed him as a peer, someone that she could trust and someone with whom she could govern. That said, though, there are Democrats who wonder if the Pennsylvania governor, Josh Shapiro, who has like a 61% approval rating in Pennsylvania being a state that Democrats need to win with its 19 electoral votes in order to win the White House, if picking Walz was the right strategic choice.
You know, I have so much respect for Governor Shapiro. I really, really like him. And I also love Mark Kelly, who's a close friend of mine, and many of the other people, Pete Buttigieg, were just incredible choices for this job. And in the end, it was the vice president's decision. And I think that chemistry matters. The fact that he's from the Midwest, when you've got states like Wisconsin and Michigan at stake, the fact that Pennsylvania, as Bob Casey has told me over and over again, you've got a whole half of that state that looks a lot more like the Midwest, and that would be the western half of Pennsylvania. I know I campaigned there for president. That feels very Midwest and associates with the Midwest. So I think you're going to see a ticket. In Kamala Harris, she decided to bring someone in that was different than herself. And I think that's a really big strength, has a way different background as a high school teacher and as someone who has served in our military. I think those are real virtues and will be especially good pairing with J.D. Vance when it comes to a debate. They doubled down on the Hulk Hogan factor, and Kamala Harris decided to go to someone that was different than herself.
Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, thanks so much for joining us this evening. We appreciate it.
It was great to be on.
Do this.
Thank you.
With Tim Walz on the Democratic ticket, it's still shaping up to be another razor-thin election.
A new poll from PBS News, NPR, and Marist shows Kamala Harris with a 3-point lead over Donald Trump nationally. That's within the poll's margin of error. For more details on where the race stands, we're joined now by Domenico Montanaro, senior political editor and correspondent for NPR. It's great to have you back.
Good to be with you.
So there's been a shift in the way that people view this election, who people think will win. A month ago, before President Biden dropped out, a clear majority thought that Donald Trump would win. Now voters see a toss-up. What's driving this change in the numbers, Domenico?
Look at that, right? It's a huge shift going from almost 20 points down where people thought that Donald Trump was going to win. You know, Kamala Harris has just brought a lot of energy to the ticket. You know, our poll was taken over the weekend before, obviously, Harris made this selection of Tim Walz. But when we look at our polling overall, she's now up 51-48 over Donald Trump. That's a huge change from just 2 weeks ago when she got into the race. And really fueling that are Black voters, white college-educated women, and independent women. We've seen a 20-point jump among Black voters, 25-point jump among white college-educated women, and 28-point jump among independent women. What I find really interesting about women who identify as independents is that in our last survey, 28% of them said that they were undecided. So a lot of people, I say, you know, a lot of people talk about how this is a honeymoon for Kamala Harris. I don't know. I think this is more like the liquid jello phase. You know, you put it in the fridge and see if it solidifies. And we're starting to see things gel.
Jello metaphor is always so relatable. Let's look at the bigger picture here, though, right? You have a new battleground map that NPR is out with just today. There are just three states that you consider to be true toss-ups right now, the so-called blue wall states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. So, Domenico, walk us through here. What are the potential paths to victory for the campaign?
Well, you know, the national poll is great, right? But when we talk about what wins in the election, it is these, you know, key battleground states. And really, it's split into two categories. You've got the three states that are pure toss-ups in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, which make up the blue wall, right? If Kamala Harris wins each of those three states, then she's most likely going to be president of the United States. Now, she also has a path with the Sun Belt states, where Arizona, Nevada out west, Georgia, North Carolina in the east. If she were to maybe add one of those, she could do a little bit worse in the Sun Belt or in the blue wall and still be able to pull it off. For Donald Trump, though, he really needs to win those Sun Belt states, all four of them. You know, even with all four of those, he's only at 268 electoral votes. You need 270. He's just shy of that right now. That's why for them, for their campaign, they think about two places, Pennsylvania and Georgia. They're spending 77% of all of their ad money right now in just those two states. Why? Because he could lose everything else that we've been talking about. If he wins Pennsylvania and Georgia, he's right at 270.
And that brings us back to our lead story. Vice President Kamala Harris's pick of Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is her running mate. As we've been saying, the vast majority of Americans, based on our polls, don't know much or really anything about him. Of course, that's what campaigns are for, to help define the candidate. What does this pick do to change the race?
Well, you know, the geography teacher is going to love our map, I'm sure. But, you know, 71% of people are saying that they don't know who he is or don't have an opinion about him. So this next 2 weeks between now and the Democratic convention are going to be huge when it comes to what people think about the Harris-Walz ticket and whether or not they want that versus what we saw at the Republican National Convention, which was Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, his running mate, who has not had a good rollout whatsoever. When you look inside our poll, when we asked the favorability ratings of J.D. Vance, 55% of independents say that they have an unfavorable opinion of J.D. Vance. It's why even Donald Trump himself is saying, look, nobody cares about who the vice president is.
Domenico, we also know elections are about issues, right? So what does this new poll tell us about how people view the issues when it comes to this new Democratic ticket?
Well, I think it's really interesting because, you know, for a while, Joe Biden was really tied to the economy, right? And Donald Trump had a 9-point advantage in our June survey over Donald Trump on over Joe Biden on who do you trust most to handle the economy. Kamala Harris doesn't seem to have that sort of sticking to her as much because she is only down 3 points on the economy to Donald Trump. That's a pretty big deal, especially when the economy, as we know, is really so determinative in so many places for so many undecided voters. On immigration, she's actually gained a few points there as well. So it seems like voters right now are kind of hitting the pause button a little bit, and they're going to judge for themselves what they think about Kamala Harris and her policies, along with Tim Walz, compared to what they already felt really cemented in these views about Joe Biden.
In the minute we have left, what other top lines stood out to you in this poll?
Well, the survey really just tells us how much momentum we've seen Kamala Harris really have. I'm really curious, though, with younger voters, when you look inside the numbers, she's not doing quite as well as I think she would like to with younger voters. It's really almost a split at this point for voters who are under 45. So she's going to need to be able to use that. You know, Walz is a big, has a big online following. A lot of people really like him who are younger progressives. We'll see if that winds up helping some of the enthusiasm along the lines. And we've also seen some of those people who are saying that they definitely are going to be voting, key groups now saying, by big margins, now saying that they're more likely to vote.
Domenico Montanaro, always great to see you. Thanks so much.
You too. Thank you.
We start the day's other headlines in Bangladesh, where Nobel laureate Muhammad Yunus has been selected to lead that country's new interim government until new elections can take place. The 84-year-old microfinance pioneer is widely respected in Bangladesh. His appointment comes a day after longtime Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina resigned and fled the country following weeks of protests that left nearly 300 people dead. On the streets of the capital today, a sense of calm returned to the once violent streets. Students stepped in to direct traffic while police went on strike to protest violence against officers during the unrest. An Israeli military raid today in the occupied West Bank killed 10 Palestinians amid increasing fears of a larger war in the region. 10 others were wounded. Meantime, to the north, sirens blared and smoke billowed near Israel's northern border with Lebanon as Hezbollah launched a barrage of drones for a second day. Israel fired rockets in response. At least 19 people were hurt. In a televised address, Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, vowed more violence against Israel for its recent strike in Beirut that killed a top commander there.
After the assassination of the martyr leader Syed Fuad, Hezbollah also sees itself obligated to respond. And Iran will respond. And Hezbollah will respond. Our response, God willing, will be strong, influential, and effective.
Separately, Hamas has named its leader in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, as its new political chief. Sinwar is widely considered the architect of the October 7th attack on Israel. He's been in hiding ever since and is at the top of Israel's kill list. He replaces Ismail Haniyeh, who was assassinated in Tehran last week. A Pakistani man has been charged with allegedly plotting to carry out political assassinations here in the U.S. According to a criminal complaint unsealed today, Asif Merchant spent time in Iran before flying to New York in April to recruit hitmen for the job. The 46-year-old was arrested last month and charged with murder for hire. In a statement, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland said the Justice Department will not tolerate attempts by an authoritarian regime to target American public officials and endanger America's national security. The National Transportation Safety Board released some 4,000 pages related to its ongoing investigation into a door panel blowout on a Boeing 737 MAX jet back in January. The co-pilot of the Alaska Airlines flight is quoted as saying it was chaos. At a rare investigative hearing today, witnesses for Boeing and its supplier, Spirit AeroSystems, outlined design changes that should prevent future blowouts. But the NTSB chair emphasized that past shortcomings, including four missing bolts in the Alaska Airlines door plug. So if we
could back. This isn't a PR campaign for Boeing. You can talk all about where you are today. There's going to be plenty of time for that. We want to know these safety improvements. But what is very confusing for a lot of people who are watching, who are listening, is what was going on then. This is an investigation on what happened on January 5th.
The NTSB chair also said that Boeing has a long way to go to improve its safety culture. The hearing continues tomorrow. In California, firefighters are battling blazes both old and new.
Hey, get out of there! Go! Go, go, go!
The Edge Hill Fire in San Bernardino, east of Los Angeles, erupted on Monday afternoon. Some residents had just minutes to evacuate before flames ignited hillsides and completely engulfed homes. As of earlier today, that fire was 75% contained. Hundreds of miles to the north, the Park Fire has been wreaking havoc since late July and is still only 34% contained. It's the fourth largest fire in California's history and has burned more land in the state than all of last year's fires combined. Bloomberg Philanthropies is donating $600 million to the endowments of four historically black medical schools. Founder Michael Bloomberg announced the funds at the annual convention of the National Medical Association, a group that advocates for African-American physicians. Almost half of black physicians graduate from the four historically black medical schools, and the donations will more than double the size of three of the school's endowments. On Wall Street today, stocks recovered some after Monday's sell-off. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added nearly 300 points, but closed off its highs of the day. The NASDAQ rose 166 points, or about 1%. The S&P 500 also added 1% on the day. And we have the day's Olympic headlines now, which include some gold medals and some spoiler alerts. The track and field finals in Paris today quickly turned into a golden hour for Team USA. In the men's 1500 meters, Cole Hocker pulled off a stunning upset, beating a competitive field and topping his own personal best by 3 seconds. Just a short time later in the women's 200, Gabby Thomas sprinted her way to gold after a third-place finish at the last Olympics. Meantime, on the soccer field, Sophia Smith sent the U.S. women's soccer team to the finals after scoring the winning goal against Germany in extra time. They'll face Brazil for gold on Saturday. So as of this evening, the U.S. has racked up 86 medals overall, well ahead of the next best, which is China. Still to come on the NewsHour, a new initiative tries to improve health by bringing care to patients. A rare look at the personal stories behind the stars on the CIA Memorial Wall. And a well-known chef takes his taste buds global in a new TV series.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Tropical storm Debbie is dumping historic amounts of rain as it stalls over South Carolina. That's one day after it lashed Florida with hurricane strength. At least five deaths have been reported so far. Communities are now submerged across several states, while some of the largest impacts are on travel. Stephanie Tsai has our report.
Today, flash flooding in South Carolina as Debbie deluges the state.
That is completely underwater.
The slow-moving storm is unleashing downpours on cities like Charleston, where the mayor has ordered pumps be brought in to remove excess water. South Carolina's governor said heavy precipitation is expected to last until Thursday.
We will see a lot of rain, not that much wind, but a lot of rain, and this storm is creeping across our state, creeping across.
Similar scenes are playing out in southern Georgia. Authorities say Savannah's airport got a month's worth of rain in just one day. Debbie caused at least one death in the state when a tree fell on a house, killing the 19-year-old man inside. Debbie blasted ashore in Florida's Big Bend yesterday as a Category 1 hurricane. Rain-soaked soil and hurricane-force winds combined to topple trees, including on Bill Franco's house in Jacksonville.
Yeah, we've been lucky. We've had some bad storms and just a couple branches on the ground. Maybe that was it till now.
Some of the most intense rainfall hit southwestern Florida, where one resident found a catfish swimming in his driveway.
Behind me it's flooded, in front of me it's flooded.
As Debbie passed Florida, it left some neighborhoods completely inundated. First responders in Sarasota patrolled low-lying areas by boat on roads that had become rivers.
We are going to see more flooding in northern Florida.
Today, Governor Ron DeSantis warned that the waters will continue to rise.
When it dumps in southern Georgia, it makes its way down to us.
The storm has also stifled air travel, causing thousands of flight cancellations and delays nationwide.
No answers, you know, I'm sitting around waiting.
Al Gremmel says he's been trying to travel south for days.
So it's just frustrating. all in general. I get the weather is the cause, but hey, give me some better information so I can plan.
Among the most affected is American Airlines, with hubs in Miami and Charlotte. New forecasts say the storm could hover over the Atlantic Ocean for a few days, then return inland with even more moisture. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
In the city of Baltimore, 94% of residents there have some form of health insurance, yet many face alarming disparities, including higher rates of chronic diseases and shorter lifespans. As special correspondent Christopher Booker reports, one program is trying to overcome barriers by providing health care straight to people's doorsteps.
Hey, sweetie. You want your blood pressure checked today?
Tuesday mornings are busy in Johnston Square Apartments in East Baltimore.
Well, hi, Ms. Kiana.
Set up in the lobby, nurses offer free basic checkups for anyone who may be passing through.
Nice and relaxed, okay?
71-year-old Laverne Clark has lived here for 6 years, and these weekly nurse visits have become part of her routine.
Make sure my heart rate is good. You know, it really helped me a lot with all my medications.
Nurses say many in this predominantly black neighborhood face barriers to health care. There is a shortage of primary health care doctors, and transportation to providers can be difficult.
This community is insured, but if you ask them when's the last time you've seen your provider or do you have the medications that you need, that's where things fall apart.
Tiffany Reiser is a nurse practitioner and part of this pilot project that organizers call Neighborhood Nursing. Launched in January, the aim is to bring health care to communities block by block.
If you remember back in the good old days, doctors used to make house calls quite regularly, and now that's quite a rare thing. And that disconnect, I think, is what led to our healthcare system forgetting that this is where people spend most of their time. When you see them in their home, you really get an in-depth understanding of the challenges that they're facing.
As he broke it down by needs, then broke it down by insurance.
The team consists of nurses and a community healthcare worker who helps residents work through any problems they have accessing healthcare.
I lost a wallet, really.
Oh, what was in your wallet?
All of my identification, all my important papers.
79-year-old Andrew Hampton hadn't seen a primary care physician in years, partly because he didn't have any identification. The team helped him replace his ID and recently scheduled an appointment with a doctor.
We're hoping that with this recent visit, we're able to get him plugged into the care that he already is covered for
right.
And has paid into. Just a matter of getting it to his front door.
America spends more per capita on health care than any other high-income country. Yet we have the lowest life expectancy at birth, the highest rates of death for treatable or avoidable conditions, and the highest rates of infant and maternal mortality.
Experts say making preventative primary care more accessible through programs like this one in Baltimore could make a difference.
If we can do it universally, where everyone gets it, where it's like a right, like a utility, then we'll be able to reach the promise of preventive care, that it's not just reactive and that we're preventing things for everyone and everyone could be at their greatest health.
Sarah Zanton is the dean of the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing and leads the philanthropy-funded program, a collaboration with the University of Maryland, Morgan State, and Coppin State Schools of Nursing. She says by next year, they plan to bring primary health care to more than 4,000 Baltimore residents, regardless of their insurance coverage.
The vision is that we will go door to door, be in the laundromats, in the libraries, in the schools, sort of blanketed so that everyone has access to a nurse and a community health worker.
The approach was inspired by a public health program developed more than 1,000 miles away in Costa Rica, where healthcare workers aim to visit every resident nationwide in their home at least once a year.
They might come back to visit them if they have high needs. They might connect them with other parts of the public health or nutrition system. And all the time, they connect them with the acute and chronic care that that person might need.
Harvard School of Public Health's Dr. Asaf Bitton has studied the impact of Costa Rica's model.
Costa Rica has significantly improved the health of its population across both what we call communicable diseases, those are infectious diseases that can often be prevented with vaccines and other antibiotics, as well as non-communicable diseases.
Costa Rica has achieved those better health outcomes while spending less than a tenth of what the U.S. spends per person on health care.
We tend to focus on people who are sick as opposed to focusing on keeping people well or identifying problems early to help avoid more serious problems later on.
Melinda Abrams is the executive vice president for programs at the Commonwealth Fund, a healthcare research organization. She says the complicated nature of healthcare in the United States would make it difficult to expand a program like neighborhood nursing beyond Baltimore.
The major barrier right now, in my opinion, is the financing. We tend to focus on hospitalizations and specialty. We're really focused on individual services, which incentivizes more volume, as opposed to having clinicians be accountable for both the quality and outcomes for patient and patient care.
Back at Johnson Square Apartments, this new approach has started to see small wins. Calls to 911 from the building are down. And organizers say the community has started to take the effort beyond the weekly checkups.
I went to a meeting where it was shared with me that people in my zip code, this area, our life expectancy is not as long as in other areas. And that bothered me.
Longtime resident Regina Hammond suggested the nurses help create a neighborhood exercise group. They now take weekly walks, and on days when it's too hot, they work out indoors.
Why was there a need for a walking group?
Because a lot of people don't venture too far because they don't want to walk alone. Some people don't feel safe. It's about getting out. It's about learning who's in your neighborhood. It's about looking at beautiful flowers, being able to talk with a nurse walking beside you, talking to them about things that nobody took the time to listen to you about. So it's serving a lot of purposes.
She hopes to see this initiative grow beyond her neighborhood. That, Abrams says, is possible, but will require collaboration.
What it would take is federal policymakers, state policymakers, the hospitals, the doctors, and the insurance companies to come together to agree to pivot and invest more on prevention and primary care. No mistake, that is very hard to do. But I'm optimistic because there are a number of communities that are experimenting with this right now.
It was 115 over 70.
But for now, in this community, these nurses will keep showing up week after week. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Christopher Booker in Baltimore.
Years ago, the Central Intelligence Agency unveiled a memorial to CIA members killed in service to the country. It was first established with typical institutional quiet in the original headquarters lobby. Today, the memorial wall has become hallowed ground. Nick Schifrin has this rare look from Langley, Virginia.
It is the intelligence community's most solemn sight. 140 stars carved into Alabama marble. A permanent memorial, each star, one life lost. But also a nameless collective commemoration of sacrifice. Killed CIA members get the same star no matter their seniority. And each star, born from this Virginia studio. Tim Johnston carves a replica destined for the fallen's family. Using the same decades-old stencil, leading with perfect symmetry to a single central point. Johnston has been carving the memorial wall stars for 35 years.
I don't give them one shot, and I can't mess up. You know, carved in stone, as the old saying goes.
Johnston took over from his mentor and the man who built the wall and its initial stars, Harold Vogel. That was five decades ago, when the wall had 33 stars. By 2003, there were 80. Today, there are 140.
The meaning behind the people and the work that they have done and the sacrifice they made, I mean, every star is a life.
When you walk into CIA and you see that memorial wall and the stars, what do you think?
Each one of those stars represents a familial sacrifice that I understand way too well.
Calista Anderson and her father have tried to visit the memorial wall every year since her mother, his wife, Jennifer Matthews, was killed in 2009 in Afghanistan by a suicide bomber who Matthews, CIA's counterterrorism personnel, and CIA leadership thought was an Al-Qaeda mole.
What do you see in her face when you look at that photo?
I almost see my own face, to be honest with you. I just remember her as such a great mom. She was just such a, effervescent person and really bubbly, just really caring, and made a lot of effort to know us as kids and like know our personalities and talk with us.
Matthews worked for CIA's Alex Station, responsible for tracking Al-Qaeda and hunting Osama bin Laden. At CIA, she knew Al-Qaeda as well as anyone.
One of her coworkers even told me one time, I think she forgot more about Al-Qaeda than I ever knew about it. So it's sometimes really nice to hear, and then sometimes I'm almost in awe of my own mom.
That knowledge came later. Anderson and her younger brothers didn't even know where their mom worked. When Matthews died, her daughter was 12.
I never got to pick out a prom dress with her. I'll never pick out a wedding dress with her. So things like that can be really difficult. But I'm extremely grateful for the grief, because as people say, it's an echo of lost love. So for me, I'll have the grief for the rest of my life. I don't think it'll ever go away. But I'm really grateful that I'm able to feel that, because I felt so much love.
Anderson has avoided dramatic depictions of her mother, including the film Zero Dark Thirty, as well as a CIA after-action report acknowledging lapses across the agency that contributed to the death of Matthews and six other CIA officers.
I understand from an institutional point of view that that question is very important, but from the point of view of myself, my mom was already gone. I miss my mom. Like, that's not a organizational figure to me. That's not a worker or, a job position. She's a real person and a real family member who I no longer have in my life.
For my colleagues here at the agency, for me personally, the role is not an abstraction. Each of those stars has a profound human story behind them.
Bill Burns is the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He looks at these stars and feels collective and personal loss.
One of them is a very good friend of mine, Matthew Gannon, with whom I served 4 decades ago, my first post as a young career diplomat. He was killed in the terrorist bombing of Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, on his way home from a temporary assignment in Beirut to his wife and 2 young daughters for Christmas. It reminds me that this is an intensely human profession. We are a human intelligence service.
When CIA created the wall 50 years ago, the agency was under siege, accused of co-opting student groups and NGOs, training domestic police forces, and abuses in Vietnam. And in 1973, President Nixon fired Director Richard Helms for refusing to assist in the Watergate cover-up. His replacement, James Schlesinger, forced 7% of the agency to retire and was described as Nixon's revenge.
Was the wall, in some ways, a rehabilitation?
For all of those problems and mistakes and flaws that you just described, which were very real, there was also a legacy of courage and dedication and patriotism, too. And so I think in that sense, it was a part of that renewal, I think, at the agency, but also to remember the sacrifice that marks this agency and does to this day.
What do you see in your father when you look at these photos?
Well, this first one, his dad really... when he still had some hair. So
Tim Welch lost his father 49 years ago, Richard Welch, assassinated at 46 years old when he was the CIA's chief of station in Athens.
This is May of 1975. He's pinning my second lieutenant Marine Corps bars on me. This is for merit. This is the Intelligence Medal of Merit. Extremely proud of my father. Smartest guy in the room. Great sense of humor, great empathy. Hero worship in the sense that, I saw this guy sort of going, getting on planes and going all over the world and being promoted. Got to a very high, very high rank.
At the time, Dick Welch was CIA's highest ranking officer killed while on duty. He received full military honors. And was buried in Arlington National Cemetery, normally reserved for the military. His funeral was attended by President Ford, National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Welch admits his father prioritized his career over his family, but even decades later, grief is like a permanent hole that sometimes opens up.
The last time I saw him, I drove him to JFK, to the TWA terminal. We had a goodbye beer at the CWA terminal. And That was, I can still remember seeing him go down, you know, the Aero Serena and TWA with those bright red carpets they had, you know, and so forth. I can still remember him going down to the plane there.
Is it hard still to talk about this sometimes?
Of course. It comes and goes.
Welcher's killer wasn't caught for a quarter century, past the statute of limitations, so no one was ever charged with his murder.
In our family, we have a very clear idea. We do not consider ourselves victims. We do not consider him a victim, and we don't talk about closure. He was doing a tough job. He knew what he was doing. And as far as we're concerned, he died in the line of duty doing what he wanted to do in the service of the United States.
At the time, CIA kept a book of the fallen, some names still secret. This photo of the original book has never before been public. Its final name, Richard Welch. Today, that book lives inside the case that holds a new book, which is double in size. And every year, CIA holds an annual memorial ceremony for the families.
We all attended the ceremony in May. Being there with the family, with the agency family, and you know, now we're, you know, older guy, and we go there and we see young kids who are bereaved.
Allowing us to be there and almost have a sort of catharsis grief moment among sort of your family and the people who best understand and best share it with you.
A family whose sacrifice is forever carved in stone. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin in Langley, Virginia.
It's a tasting menu at the highest possible level. The Copenhagen restaurant Noma has helped transform the world of fine dining with a focus on hyperlocal foods prepared and presented with extraordinary care. Now its co-owner and chef widens his view to explore ingredients that have changed the globe. Jeffrey Brown reports for our arts and culture series, Canvas. Everybody got a pepper?
Yes. Yes.
Let's have a fantastic service.
Yes, sir.
The fire in a bite of chili. The pleasure in a cup of coffee. The raw wonder of sushi. But what's behind it all? Food is never just food. That's the theme that runs through Omnivore, an 8-part series on Apple TV Plus that takes us around the world to look at the production, history, culture, and sustainability of 8 key ingredients that go into much of what we eat.
An endless flight to Australia.
After the guide, Chef René Redzepi.
I think it's a new way of actually trying to understand a little bit about who are we through the foods that we've eaten. And that's what we're trying to do.
Is it your sense that most of us don't know this or don't stop to think about it? We just consume?
Yes, we just consume. I don't think I could have said it much better. I think we are so far removed from where our food comes from and what lies behind. And we have lost touch with that.
Redzepi is one of the world's best-known chefs, complete with a recent cameo on the FX on Hulu series, The Bear. His Copenhagen restaurant, Noma, earning 3 Michelin stars and regularly ranked world's best, became ground zero for what's been called New Nordic Cuisine, a hugely influential approach to food gathering, preparation, and presentation, featuring unexpected, hyper-local, and seasonal ingredients.
Simple idea was, we're in the Nordics. What is available to us? And we discovered this new treasure trove of ingredients, particularly wild foods. And we found seagrass that tastes like coriander. There was roots of trees that tasted like cinnamon. Flavors that were, you know, exotic to the average Danes, but they were right there underneath our feet. That whole thing fueled like a lifetime of curiosity.
Omnivore, a collaboration with food journalist Matt Goulding and filmmaker Kari Fukunaga, explores how once local ingredients rose to global scale. There's one ingredient per episode: chilies, tuna, salt, bananas, pork, rice, coffee, corn.
We're trying with the show to just give people an inspiration to want to try to understand more about the everyday things that we eat and just how mind-blowing it is and how many wonderful stories and people lies behind the everyday stuff like a cup of coffee or a bowl of rice.
Arthur Karoletwa has made it his life's mission to fight for the people who produce our coffee.
Mind-blowing, too, in the geopolitical, economic, and environmental impacts these ingredients have had in the past and that continue in various forms today. As the Global Food Network changes local cultures and lessens food variety.
What jumped out at me is that there's a sense of loss almost as much as a sense of wonder.
It is true that within the food system and how we produce food, that it has a huge toll on everything. And it is true that the craftspeople, they are disappearing slowly. And with that, some of our culture get lost. And I believe some of the very essence of who we are get lost if we don't remember to celebrate them and value their work.
If the appetites of all of us as humans are behind many of the food resource problems you're documenting here, can our appetites be changed?
Yeah, I have no doubt that we can change. I think at the heart of change in food lays deliciousness. I think that's the change factor for us as a species adapting new ways. If things taste amazing, we're going to be there very quick, and it's going to travel throughout the world when something delicious hits us. So this also tells you that, yes, the human appetite can be ferocious, but we can quickly change things around. So we have to have that hope and that knowledge and that optimism.
But that too cuts both ways, as the series shows with the example of bluefin tuna, which turned from trash fish into treasure, think sushi, through changes in global shipping, business, and tastes, to the point of a new threat from overfishing. The series focuses on efforts to preserve local practices, resources, and food varieties amid such pressures. Sustainability is also a factor in Redzepi's world of fine dining. In fact, citing grueling hours, endless workplace demands, and the high cost of the labor-intensive work, he announced last year that despite its critical success, Noma would close as a traditional restaurant by the end of 2024. It will now become a food laboratory to develop, test, and market new flavors and foods. I asked how he sees the role of chefs like himself in changing food awareness and habits.
I think for me, I've always believed and still believe today that chefs, they are sort of ambassadors for seasonality, for flavor, for the love of a meal. And they act as a sort of almost a community hub where flavor happens. And they spread that into the world. I always believe that they have that impact and we have that impact.
The 8-part series Omnivore is now streaming. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
Before we go, an update to our lead story.
Vice President Kamala Harris introduced her new presidential running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, tonight. The duo made their first joint campaign appearance at a rally in the crucial swing state of Pennsylvania.
Since the day that I announced my candidacy, I set out to find a partner who can help build this brighter future. A leader who will help unite our nation and move us forward. So, Pennsylvania, I'm here today because I found such a leader. Governor Tim Walz of the great state of Minnesota.
I couldn't be prouder to be on this ticket and to help Vice President Harris become what we all know is very, very good for us to think about. Next president of the United States of America.
The Harris-Walz campaign says it's raised more than $20 million since this morning's announcement.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. For all of us here at the PBS NewsHour, thanks for spending part of your evening with us.